You are listening to a free version of Majority Report with Sam Steeter. To support the show and get another 15 minutes of daily program, go to majority.fm, please.
The Majority Report with Sam Steeter. It's time to look in the mirror, America. Do you like what you see?
I keep referring to Obama as the magic Negro.
Do you like what you see now?
Well, suck on this.
It's just a mirror, America.
Shared sacrifice by everybody.
What could it do to you except reflect your image?
I did nothing wrong at the Minneapolis airport.
The Majority Report.
Far more credible to me than PBS
and Frontline.
The Majority Report with Sam Steeter.
Ever get the feeling you've been cheated?
It is Tuesday, March 3rd, 2015. My name is Sam Steeter. This is the three-time award-winning Majority Report. We are broadcasting live. Just steps from the Supreme Court of the United States in Washington, D.C. On the program today, coverage of the case that is in front of the Supreme Court today, Halbig versus Burwell, a case that we have spoken of on this program quite a bit, and I'm not sure that we're going to be able to offer any particularly new information, but I have told you people, I have warned you people time and time again that on this, the listeners of this program will be the most informed people, or I should say the most informed audience of really just about anything in regards to Halbig versus Burwell. And the reason for this is, the reason why it's so important in my mind is not simply, although that would be enough, that you could see literally millions of people without health insurance. Thousands of people, according to studies, I think up to 10,000 people die per year because of, if the court finds for the plaintiffs in this case. It would, I guess on the upshot, it might mean the destruction of the health insurance industry, although I would imagine it would just mean it would become far more expensive. I don't think there's anything that's good, let's put it that way, that could come out of a ruling for the plaintiffs here. But I also, what fascinates me is, long-time listeners of this program will know that I have thought that the Supreme Court had been mostly, I mean, fully compromised since 2000. And this case seems to be the one where I think a lot of people, there's going to be a lot of, if they find for the plaintiffs, I think it's going to be very hard to make the argument that the Supreme Court as an institution is really founded or in any way tethered to the law. And one of the interviews, I've been interviewing people all morning. I'm actually going to play an interview I did with Professor Abby Gluck from Yale. I phoned her this morning. And then later in the program, I'll be talking to John McDonough, who is a health expert. I'll get his comments on this as well, but he was one of the people who were advising Vermont on their single-payer move, and I want to talk about why that failed. But this morning I've been interviewing people, and one was an attorney with a private firm now who filed an amicus brief on behalf of Families USA, who are managing the Radio Row here today. And it's interesting to see, you know, just as we were talking, it's quite clear that the legal arguments in this case, and it's always been an element of this, and maybe it's just a question of degree, but the legal arguments have now been basically relegated to these sort of pundit talking points that that are not terribly good. I'm just sitting here. I just saw Senator Sherrod Brown has come into Radio Row, and I would like to talk to him. Clearly, he either ran over here after the Bibi Netanyahu speech or didn't go. Let me see if I can wave and get the attention of the... This is the tough part also of not having a producer here. I want to see if I can get the senator on. One moment, folks. Let me see if I can finagle this, because I would love to talk to Sherrod Brown. So bear with me. I was going to play this pre-recorded interview, but if I can get Sherrod Brown live. There's not many politicians I want to talk to. Is there any way I could get the senator? I'm on live now, but would you ask Candy for me? Thanks. This is the way it works in radio, folks. I'm live right now as well. Okay. So I guess it's just going to Ohio. What are you going to do, folks? But we're here today, obviously, talking about the case. These are going to be the oral arguments. They are going to be the case won't be resolved until June or July. I'd take him for 2 or 3 minutes. So this is how the sausage is made, folks. There's a negotiation. I understand. There you go. I did my best there, ladies and gentlemen. In fact, let's take a... got another guest in at 12:30. So perhaps... This is what it's like. We're doing a live broadcast here, and I'm just trying to negotiate to see if I can get a guest who has just walked in unannounced. And so if I can do so, I will do so. One of the things I was hoping to do was also to play an interview that was pre-taped, but I don't want that to back up if I get the chance of talking to Sherrod Brown. So, all right, we're going to go. We're going to take a quick break, and then we'll go into this interview with Abby Gluck. We are back. Sam Cedar on the Majority Report. I am here across the street from the Supreme Court when oral arguments are set to begin in the case of King versus Burwell. On the phone with me to talk about the case is Professor of Law from Yale University, Abby Gluck. Abby, thanks so much for joining us.
Thanks for having me.
So let's, for those people and, you know, I've, for those people who are unfamiliar with this case, just give us the broad strokes in addition to the uniqueness of this case reaching the Supreme Court at this point in the history of the case.
Okay, so for non-lawyers, the important thing to understand is the case has enormous implications and enormous consequences. What the challenges are asking the court to do basically to render insurance marketplaces more than half the states dysfunctional based on how they've implemented the Affordable Care Act. That's going to deprive more than 8 million Americans of their health. The case as a legal matter turns on how the statute is written. The statutory interpretation case, it's not a constitutional law challenge to Congress's power. We had that challenge in 2012. This is a case which the challengers are seizing on a few words in this 1,000-page law to say that Congress intended this kind of collapse of these state insurance.
And when we say they're looking on like literally a couple of words, we're looking at a couple of words, like you say, out of thousands. The Affordable Care Act was famously so long that nobody read it, supposedly. But that's just rhetoric. The bottom line is, when you take these words out of context, they suggest that the federal exchanges. The federal exchanges are not eligible for subsidies.
Right. The whole statute turns on these new insurance reforms that give Americans access to insurance at cheaper prices. And to make those reforms economically sustainable, the Act requires everybody to get insured and therefore increase the insurance pool. And to make it possible for everybody to get insured, the Act provides these very critical subsidies that make insurance affordable. The Act also has a structure of federalism, states' rights, gives states the right of first refusal to operate these new insurance marketplaces themselves. But if they don't, the federal government has to step in and operate them. And this is where the challenge comes in, because what the challengers are saying is that there are four words in the statute buried deep into the tax provisions that they arguably claim say that if a state has decided not to run its own insurance exchange, and if the federal government steps in, these subsidies aren't available. And then it's a domino effect, and the insurance markets wind up collapsing.
And explain, you know, we've spoken in the past to Stephanie Menenser, who wrote a piece on the actual plaintiffs. And it's not so unique in the context of these type of cases that you'll see plaintiffs picked by an advocacy group that really wants to forward a policy or a law or a change in society. So that part of it's not so unique. But what is specifically the plaintiff's contention? That how are they specifically damaged?
These four plaintiffs in particular are damaged?
Yeah, I mean, there must be, yeah. Right? That's the basis of it, theoretically, anyways.
Right. The case has its roots, as you say, in a conservative meeting in which anti-Obamacare proponents were encouraged to find any way to get the statute struck down or weakened. And it was urged to take the fight to Congress. It was urged to take the fight to the courts if that failed. We all know they took the statute to Congress more than 40 times and couldn't get it repealed. So now this political battle's in the court. And the last couple of weeks, there's been some focus on who these plaintiffs are, who they found to represent the case that they're bringing to the court. And it turns out that it's not entirely clear that whether any of these plaintiffs actually suffered the requisite individual harm to bring a case to the court. Neither side has actually brought that up to the court. We don't know if the court is going to seize on that. And I think the more important message from this uncertainty about whether the plaintiffs even know the kind of case that they're bringing goes to this idea that the whole case is really political. It's been part of a political strategy. It's not like there are these four people who said, I was hurt by Obamacare and I need to take my case to the Supreme Court. It's been an orchestrated political attempt to take the statute down.
And what do you think the chances are? I mean, I want to get to the piece you wrote the other day. I think it was in Politico about the notion of states' rights and how that fits into this case. But before we get there, because what do you think the likelihood of? And you've spoken, I think, briefly touched on the uniqueness of this ending up in this in the Supreme Court at this point, when you have no constitutional questions that need to be resolved, when you don't have a split or you hadn't sort of given enough time or ripeness for a split to occur on the circuit court level. In the event that the court wants to figure out a way of finding
that the plaintiffs will not prevail. Is standing a possibility? I mean, is it, at this level, could the court find, like, this case just doesn't work because these four plaintiffs don't actually have standing?
Yes, the court always has the power to raise those issues itself, and the court could do so. I think that neither side really wants to do that at this time. I think that the case is briefed, it's here, and I think people sort of want the decision. It's certainly possible the justices could do that. They haven't asked for any supplemental briefing. They haven't requested any information on the standing issue. Oral argument is short. It's only 30 minutes per side. So, you know, I have some concern that the court is going to waste valuable time on the standing issue. They're not going to have the case turn on the standing issue. That might be something of a waste because the Affordable Care Act is very complicated, and the court needs to let the lawyers take their time to explain the case to them properly. And I hope that the oral argument focuses on those issues of importance. Standing is obviously very important, but if the court is not going to focus on it in the opinion, I would hope that the actual argument focuses on the rest of the merits.
And so just to be clear, when the court spends time on standing, that is a more generic, question, right? I mean, that's one that could apply to any given case as opposed to the specifics in this case. And so tell us, like, from your perspective, what is the most important question for them to settle in terms of what kind of precedents may be set here? Or is it really just furtherance of a means in which to interpret statute?
Well, interpretation of statutes is a very important area of law. The vast majority of the Supreme Court's docket involves interpreting statutes. When you think about all the big cases you think of in the last couple of years, Clean Air Act, voting rights, Arizona immigration case, all those cases are cases of statutory interpretation. All cases about what did Congress write on this law and what did Congress mean. So you can't underestimate the importance of the legal questions just because there's not a constitutional law issue at stake. And you know, I teach legislation, and I think the case is very important for law because what the challenges are doing is they're saying to the court, here's a 1,000-page statute that's pretty complicated. We are going to have you look at four words, and we're going to have you read them alone out of the context of the rest of the statute, and we're going to tell you that's the right way to interpret statute. And that's a big mistake. The Supreme Court has said for years and years that you have to look at the rest of the statute. You have to read statutory text in context. What the government is saying is that when you look at the statute as a whole, the challenger's reading just doesn't make any sense. A lot of other provisions just can't work in the statute without the federal subsidies. And the court is always presumed that Congress does not write statutes to fall to pieces. And so that, to me, is the most important, the big principle. Okay.
And so, I mean, just to reiterate, too, that I guess that point is just Congress would never write a statute to build a car and specifically leave out an engine in some way.
That's right. That's right. And the court always gives Congress the benefit of the doubt in these situations, especially when the statute isn't crystal clear. And there's really, it's also very important to understand that there's no other statute in the entire U.S. Code, in the entire U.S. legal system, that has a structure where Congress gives the states the right of first refusal, sets up a federal fallback. There are lots of those. There are none of them when the federal fallback kicks in that the whole scheme falls to pieces. That's just unprecedented. And if that isn't crystal clear from the language of the statute, the Supreme Court shouldn't read the statute that way.
All right. And just to be clear about this, because this is an important point that you make in the context of your piece. Give us another example of a piece of legislation that has that dynamic where the state has an option to do something, and in the event that they don't, the federal government will do it. Why are things set up that way?
Okay, so you got many statutes, all the environmental laws, the Clean Air Act, the Clean Water Act, the Occupational Health and Safety Act. Statutes are set up this way in this parallel fashion out of respect for federalism, the states' rights, right? The idea that Congress is legislating in a new area, often it's an area that states have traditionally regulated, like health care, and states want the option to implement the federal law themselves. It's their state, if they're the experts, And Congress set the statutes up in this way. That's exactly what happened in the Affordable Care Act. We had these major new insurance regulations, and a bunch of federalist-driven states came in and said, look, if you're going to do this to us, we want to run these insurance marketplaces themselves. But all of these statutory schemes are nationwide schemes. The reforms are enacted nationwide. So if the state doesn't do the implementation at all or doesn't do it right, there has to be a fallback. Federal government has to step in and take the statute across the finish line. That's a statutory scheme. There's another kind of statute in the U.S. Code, like Medicaid, for instance, where Congress has given the states grant money, and it basically says use it or lose it. Those statutes are very different. If the states decide they don't want the money, they don't do the program, and that's it. But Congress has made a conscious decision to let the program's success turn on the state's choice. That's not what's happening in the Affordable Care Act. That's not what happened in the Care Act. Congress has made a decision that it wants a nationwide reform, and it's not going to let the success of a statute depend on the state.
And the interesting thing is, in the last big Affordable Care Act case, where we were down here, I guess is now 2 years ago, where ultimately Medicaid, in what I think many legal experts were surprised about, Medicaid, or I guess the forced expansion, if you will, of Medicaid was struck down. And so there's sort of a mirror image here, isn't there, in terms of it's hard to sort of to claim that the federal government cannot say to the states, you must take all of Medicaid or none of it, at the same time claim that the federal government or the Congress could have created legislation that it would have punished states for not opening their own exchanges.
That's right. It's a very sort of fascinating irony that in 2012, the challengers to the Obamacare statute were the ones that applied these federalism doctrines. These federalism doctrines are rules of statutory interpretation that the court applies to say we're not going to interpret a federal statute dramatically intrude on the states unless the Congress is crystal clear about that intrusion. In 2012, Medicaid expansion was struck down under that set of doctrines. And now, ironically, that same set of doctrines actually supports the government. And so, not surprisingly, challengers haven't mentioned those doctrines this time. But I think it's going to be very hard for the court with a straight face to just ignore those doctrines full stop, given how important they were to seven justices. Seven justices came together on that vote of the Medicaid extension. Seven justices of 2012 spoke those doctrines. And they're certainly applicable here, but this time they happen to favor the government.
Let's just talk just briefly of, of course, the irony of that is that is not the, assuming that most of the fans of the Affordable Care Act, I don't mean to make this so colloquial, but assuming most of the fans of the Affordable Care Act are left-leaning or have a vision of a government that involves a strong federal government, For the Supreme Court to sort of rule on that notion, that it is a question of states' rights, it would be obviously hugely important for those people who rely on insurance or affordability to get insurance. But from a precedent standpoint, it again weakens the power of the federal government to do things.
I think that's right. I think that federalism doctrines have their proponents and they have their opponents. There are many nationalist folks who really don't want these doctrines to curtail the power of the federal government, and there are many folks on the states' rights side who really believe in those doctrines. And it's true that sort of where the doctrines fall in this case, who they support is flipped. I don't think it's a coincidence that you don't have tons of liberal groups coming out and talking about these federalism doctrines. In fact, they were pretty much buried in the case until the very final stages. In the last stage of briefing, the state of Virginia filed a very important brief on behalf of 20 other states invoking these doctrines. I co-authored a brief with some other federalism professors invoking these doctrines because we've been talking about them for years. And, you know, I'm a strong supporter of those doctrines myself. And then there was another brief filed by a law professor at BU that also invoked those doctrines. And so now, finally getting some attention. But for the reasons you suggest, I think that they were in advance earlier in the case, perhaps because government supporters don't generally love them, and they didn't support the people who usually support them this time around.
So give me a sense of how you think this is going to go. I mean, I know it's obviously pretty difficult, but and before you do that, I mean, how is it that you think, well, I mean, I guess reconcile that prediction or non-prediction with the idea that the court decided to hear this case, particularly at this point in its, I guess, maturation.
So the extent to which the case maybe had been decided early. So the court reached down and plucked this case up to decide it earlier than usual. It's usually the case that the court waits for a split develop between the lower courts, and it certainly waits for cases in the lower courts to finish the lower court process. Here, the D.C. Circuit, widely viewed to be the second most powerful court in the nation, was supposed to hear oral arguments at the end of December on the case. And the court actually plucked the case up to the Supremes before that, in November. And that was a surprise, because it showed that there was at least some few dumb justices there that were very eager to hear the case. And you know, my bet is that the justices who were most eager to hear the case early were the ones that were most concerned about the Affordable Care Act. Of course, you only need four votes to grant certiorari to hear the case, and you need five to win. And so the question is where those votes in the middle are going to be. In any Supreme Court case, there's always a public fascination with Justice Kennedy because he often is the middle vote. Of course, in 2012, he was with the dissenters in the last Obamacare case, so we don't really know he's going to be in the middle this time, and we're going to have to hear what he says at oral argument to get a sense of whether his vote is really in play. Then, of course, you've got the Chief Justice, who, as we all know, interpreted the 2012 case to save the statute and cares about the institutional legitimacy of the court, and he seems not to want the court to be viewed as politicized. And so it's a big question of what he's going to do in this case and whether he's going to interpret the statute as it should be interpreted and not give in to the political pressure.
Well, Abby Gluck, professor of law at Yale University, thanks so much for your time today. Genuinely appreciate it.
Thanks so much for having me.
All right, folks. So we are back now live. That interview was from earlier this morning. In just a few moments, I'm going to be talking to Senator Sherrod Brown. He's heading over here. He, of course, is a senator from Ohio. I'm not going to lie, one of my longtime favorite senators. Remember interviewing him back on the Majority Report back in the days when he was a congressman. He's just coming over to sit down. Of course, he's on Radio Row to talk about the implications of this case. King versus Burwell, and I want to apologize. I think I've been calling it Halbig versus Burwell, essentially the same case. They were combined at one point. Senator Sherrod Brown, thank you so much for joining us. Let me just make sure that I got you. I'm picking you up here. If you could just... 1, 2, 3, 4. Okay, now we got you. So, Senator, just briefly, give me a sense of, if you have a sense, that your Senate colleagues in, or particularly the Republicans, have any plan in which to deal with this. I mean, there's some people who've been speculated that in the event the Supreme Court finds in favor of the plaintiffs, Republicans are in trouble. Give me your take on that.
Well, my take is they've talked about repeal and replace 4 or 5 dozen times in the House, voted on it, talked about it in the Senate. The replace has never never seems to materialize. So I think they're so focused on these are, first of all, Sam, these are people that vote on this in the Supreme Court and in the Congress, all of whom enjoy good health insurance paid for by taxpayers. Start with that. I think they just don't think about the human lives and the individual stories and dreams. There's a young man named Jermaine Cook who is from Cleveland Heights, lives 6-8 miles from me, that is coming to Washington today to talk about what health insurance means to him in his early 30s and his family. And I don't think members of Congress think about people like Jermaine. I don't think that the Supreme Court does. And I'm hopeful that five people in the Supreme Court realize their decision could mean health insurance or not for a 250,000 Ohioans and millions elsewhere.
So the Republicans haven't come up with that part of the replace. What do Democrats do in this situation in the event that we see subsidies removed from 34 states?
Well, I think we begin to organize and push our governors and legislatures to do the right thing. We bring in people, some of the tens of thousands of people that have lost their insurance, to organize and go to legislators' offices and governors' offices and say, I've had insurance, my life's so much better, my family's taken care of, the anxiety I have is lessened. My kids are doing better in school, all the things that come from having insurance, and tell those stories to legislators and governors so they do the right thing here.
And let me ask you, in terms of the another issue, the TPP fast track authority trade, I know this is a big issue for you. Give me your sense of what the chances are for fast track to pass, because a lot of people consider that to be the key in terms of the fate of the TPP.
I'm a bit incredulous that we've seen a trade policy from NAFTA to PNTR with China to CAFTA to a whole host of other agreements. Every time one passes, our trade deficit gets worse. We lose more middle-class jobs. We see more companies that from tax law and trade law have moved over, shut down, moved overseas, and sold back into this country. Why would we do more of this? And I'm hopeful because I think people are starting to pay attention or starting to speak out. I think members of Congress are beginning to hear more and more that more of the same in trade policy from NAFTA to this is bad policy, is bad for our country, is bad for our workers.
And lastly, I know you just came over quickly from the speech that Bibi Netanyahu delivered to joint session of Congress. Give me your sense on whether or not you think it's going to impact and whether it should impact any negotiations that we have with Iran, and your assessment of how the president's doing so far in those deals.
It's no small irony that when Benjamin Netanyahu was speaking to the Congress of the United States of America to undermine an agreement that's not even finished yet, and he very specifically spoke out against it, that John Kerry, our Secretary of State, was in Geneva trying to negotiate this agreement. So I'm still hopeful. I don't think it's at all certain. I think the alternatives to an agreement are generally worse. I think it's too close to a step to war if we fail in this. I also recognize that a bad agreement's worse than no agreement, and I think Secretary Kerry understands that. A group of us met with Secretary Kerry last week. I think he's focused on doing the right thing here. I'm hopeful that we fundamentally, most importantly, keep a nuclear weapon out of the hands of the government of Iran or any of the sponsors coming from that country. That's essential. I think we're on the right path to do that.
And lastly, let me just ask you about what we're hearing from Republicans regarding ISIS. And at some level, there's a parallel here. I mean, just how far are we willing to go? Give me your sense as to, you know, we hear Republicans complaining about that we're not doing enough to deal with the threat of ISIS. What is your sense about the idea of actually putting troops on the ground and your sense of what their sense is of that?
Well, I listen to the same people advocating troops on the ground and escalating potential war, the same people that got us into Iraq. I mean, it really is the same crowd that pushed us. And if not for the Iraq war, so many of these problems in the Middle East wouldn't be happening, most notably ISIS in all likelihood. And I don't much trust the people that have advocated those policies for the last decade and a half. I think ISIS is a terrible situation, a terrible problem. We have to, with our allies, confront it. I think for the potential of a long slog troops on the ground is a bad idea.
Senator Sherrod Brown of Ohio, thanks so much for your time today.
Yeah,
genuinely
thanks,
appreciate
always.
It.
Thanks.
All right, folks. Thank you again. All right, folks. Just a couple of quick notes before we go into the fun half of the program. I'll have more interviews from the case from the Supreme Court tomorrow. The Supreme Court's Supreme Court case, King versus Burwell. Of course, Bibi Netanyahu on the floor today. Speaking to joint
session of Congress, and some other news. Apparently, Hillary Clinton, as Secretary of State, never had an official email address. It's not necessarily unprecedented, as far as we can tell, for a Secretary of State to have a private email address. What does seem to be unprecedented, at least in the era of email, is that one wouldn't have one from the U.S. government if you were the Secretary of State. And, you know, in the final analysis, I don't know how much of a problem this is. I find it somewhat problematic. Doesn't do much in terms of transparency. But what is equally concerning from a more sort of like crass perspective, Hillary Clinton must have known that the chances that she would run for president when she was Secretary of State were somewhere higher than zero. Let's say they were at 2 or 5 or 25 or 40 or 50. You get the picture. The notion that neither she nor anyone on her staff, it occurred to them, just to avoid scandal, to set up a government email account, it seems to be shocking. And my sense is, and I wasn't one of them, but my sense is that some of Clinton's supporters, people of who follow politics, who are engaged maybe in some way with policy, whatever it is, one of the senses that I got was that in over the course of the campaign with Barack Obama, they came to see a side of the Clinton machine that I think they found problematic, and that was just simply competency. And it doesn't seem like that has been wrung out of the system, like the failure of staffers to do something that seems so basic, or the ability to keep the infighting not spilling out. It's so great that it doesn't spill out into the pages of The Washington Post and The New York Times like we saw a couple of weeks ago. I mean, so, you know, the argument for Hillary Clinton is largely, well, I shouldn't say largely, that's not fair, but certainly one of the premier arguments, at least, is that she can win. And that they're not new to the rodeo, or what, however that saying is. But they seem to really keep messing up some important parts of the rodeo. With that said, when it comes to the elections of the podcast awards, we will make no such mistake. Ladies and gentlemen, today is the first day that you can vote for the Majority Report at podcastawards.com. Now, it's true, members of my staff did not immediately at 12:01 a.m. post on our site that you can vote for the Majority Report at Podcast Awards. That has been rectified because I actually got an IM from Matt Binder's dad, who was good enough to remind us to post that. So Michael has now posted it at majority.fm. You can go to podcastawards.com. Vote for us. You can vote every day. Check your email that they ask for of you to make sure that the vote has gone through. Sometimes you have to confirm the email if they're worried that you're a fake person. So vote. You can vote every single day. Matt is now IMing me saying that it is his dad, and his dad texted him as well. So, all right, fair enough. My staff isn't on the ball, but at least the parents of my staff are on the ball, and that's really the important thing. that someone ultimately is on the ball. Folks, you can support this program, firstly, today, by going and voting at Podcast Awards. I want to win our fourth consecutive Best Political Podcast Award. The award's becoming more high profile, and it's very helpful. There's only so many times I can be threatened with suit until the Podcast Awards actually pays off and brings some value. So go to podcastawards.com, vote for us. And, you know, Best of the Left is over there. You should vote for them for People's Choice. I don't know that I would vote for WTF, although, you know, Marin's had me on now, so I'm less inclined not to support the program. But even still, I'm not gonna change my tune just because he had me on. But certainly go support Best of the Left. They're up for People's Choice. If you want to be a part of this program, give me a call. 646-257-3920 is the number. 646-257-3920 is the number. I am attempting to dial in now. And the IM is working for most of the addresses, but certainly it should be working via the app. So if you want to be a part of the program, you can join us there. All right, we're going to take a break. Don't forget, you can become a member of this program by going to majority.fm. If you buy crap from Amazon, buy it through our link at majorityreportkickback.com and justcoffee.coop, fair trade coffee, tea, or chocolate. Use the coupon code majority, get 10% off. We'll be back in just a moment as soon as I can figure out how to take us out. That is not it. I'm not sure why that's not working. Hold on. Bear with me, folks. Oh, there we go. And back in a moment with the better half.